Good morning, universe, and welcome to another day. Redeemed from death and looking forward to life because of what our Lord, Jesus Christ, has done for us. You're listening to Sharper Iron, waking you up every morning with the law and gospel of the living God drawn straight from the text of Holy Scripture for you. All a part of your morning drive for the soul here on Worldwide KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, and this morning we continue during the Lucan Holy Week, looking at Luke chapter 22, the remainder of the chapter, as Jesus has his face set like flint, not only toward Jerusalem, but toward what he will achieve in Jerusalem at the cross. To help us through the text today, Luke chapter 22, verses 47 through 71, we have on the line Pastor Dustin Beck. He is pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Corpus Christi, Texas. Pastor Beck, welcome back to Sharper Iron. I've been asking people this. I don't think I've had the chance to ask you this one yet, and I'll try to make it brief. You know, what's Luke's flavor? What distinguishes him from Matthew and Mark? Or really, in one sense, why do we need him if we have Matthew already? Any thoughts?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me on, Pastor Fisk. The unique and distinct flavors that we get in Luke is we get Luke who... He himself was not there for these events, right? He came on a little bit later, at least we suppose. But Luke, he has the distinct quality that he goes out and he gets interviews from people. You know, he has the most drawn out, the most detailed encounter and recounting of Mary and of the way that that the birth of Jesus Christ took place. He goes into the details of what happens in the temple with old man Simeon and everything else. You can really tell that Luke is a scholar and that he's handling this like a reporter. Because he's not, at least, like I said, we suppose he's more than likely not an eyewitness to these things. But nevertheless, he has gone and he has put together a detailed account of all of this. And so I think it gives us a little bit different flavor than Matthew, Mark, and John, who were all there for these events. Because Luke is, he's inquisitive. The details that Luke points out sometimes are details that the other three gospel writers don't. Sure. And I think that it goes to that. He writes this like a reporter. He writes this like someone who has done his homework, you could say.
Yeah. I definitely think Luke has a flavor. What I've been trying to figure out is what flavor it is in the sense that Matthew, Mark, and John all have a very distinct flavor. Like I could pin them down. And Luke, it's almost like he's got like, I don't know if it's like, what is it, Rocky Road ice cream that has like three different things in it? It looks got like 17 different flavors going on. And it's just like, well, which one is the real one, right? And some of the ones that have stuck out for me with other guests' answers over the last month have been emphasizing the unexpected. So every one of these flavors that are working their way through the temple, the table fellowship, all this, they kind of flow into this unexpected nature of the gospel. It's okay, I can kind of see this. And the other one, I really like this one, although it's not been everyone else's favorite as I share it with people. I like to think of this as the Gospel according to St. Paul, part one, and then Acts is the Gospel according to St. Paul, part two. And then Luke is sort of just the author, right? Anyway, I think that's an interesting way to look at it too, but I like your answer quite a bit as well. The question is, again, what's the thing driving the boat, right? They all are kind of there, but what's the thing driving it?
Yeah, and I mean, Luke, in terms of the themes within it, you know, you do have a very kind of the overturning of things, right? You have, think to the Magnificat, you've got well-fed and the rich and the mighty, you know, they're being low. Instead, it's the poor and the hungry. They're the ones that are being lifted up. In the Sermon on the Plain, Jesus actually, you know, he doesn't say blessed are the poor in spirit. He just says blessed are the poor, right? And so you have, I guess I would call it kind of a little bit earthy, you know. I mean, it's a gritty gospel. It's right here in the middle of the human condition. You know, maybe that's a little bit more fine-tuned answer than just kind of a...
Yeah, well, no, I don't think there's anything wrong with your answer at all. And what it is you're hearing me as I continue to try to struggle with it. I feel like I got a handle on the other Gospels, and I'm closer, but I just don't feel like I have a handle on Luke the way I'd like to. Got plenty of text to cover today. We're in Holy Week. Context-wise, so much has been going on. The setup of the betrayal with Judas. Yesterday, we talked about that, and a little bit the day before. You got the setup of Peter's denial as well with the prophecy. They're arguing about who's the greatest while he's handing out the Lord's Supper, and they just don't get it. Context-wise, what else, though? What do you see in the last couple of chapters, or really as far back as you need to go, that is going to hit us directly today?
Okay, so everybody, I think by now most of your listeners know that the big kind of turning point in Luke's gospel is all the way back in Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9, verse 51, I believe, is when Jesus sets his face to go to Jerusalem. And from then, this little Greek particle, pronounced dei, becomes very, very important because it's the word, the phrase that says it is necessary. And from then on, everything about Jesus's countenance, everything about Jesus's mission, his purpose, it's all directed at Jerusalem, the cross, and his resurrection. That's where he's going. That's what he's doing. And he says over and over and over again, it is necessary. It is necessary. It is necessary for the Son of Man to be handed over into the hands of sinners, to be crucified and raised on the third day. So that's the trajectory that we're going with here, and that's where we find ourselves today. You know, one of the things that that I struggled with in preparing this text to discuss with you today is that this is, I think, kind of second to none. This is an account that everybody knows. This is right. An account that is so familiar that we could probably sketch it out ourselves just from memory. Right. And so you really got to kind of slam on the brakes. You got to stop and you got to look at what's happening. And you got to remember that, you know, we have four different gospel accounts. And I think especially liturgically speaking, this is not a bad thing. But I think that we tend to kind of fold the gospels in on top of each other during Holy Week each year. And so we lose some of the distinctive flavors of each of the gospels. We lose some of the things that, oh, no, that was Matthew that had that, or that was John that said that. What did Jesus say from the cross in Luke's gospel? You know, these four different gospels are four different accounts, and they are to be read. I mean, of course, they're all true. Right. You know, when the scholar or when the armchair theologian sits down to discuss the Bible, we would do well to look at the narrative that the Holy Spirit led Luke to write down in this instance.
What you're saying there is very important because I think it reflects a turn in the mindset really just in the last 25 or maybe 50 years of, of theological study. That can be at odds a little bit with some of the assumptions of faithful people who came before, but we might disagree. And that is really from fairly early on, not like 300s, but sometime in the early Middle Ages, you saw attempts at gospel harmonies. You saw attempts at lining up the words of the gospel so that we just kind of had one story. And that became solidified to the point where it's even, I believe, in our Lutheran service book, Altar Book, you have a gospel harmony to be read on Good Friday, or that can be read on Good Friday, which tells you the whole story by taking a hatchet to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and just chopping them and shoving them together. But what you lose is the story. You lose the talent of the writer who's trying to paint the picture for you of what he saw or what he's been researching. And in that sense, you miss the emphasis that they're bringing out. You can have a story that's told a certain way, and it gives an emphasis to this, and then the same story told another way, and it gives the emphasis to that. And recent scholarship, and I think you're implying, and I totally agree with you, that they each have their own reason for writing. God gave us four gospels on purpose. He didn't give us one. He didn't want us to, like, tear it apart. He wants us to read them separately. And so when we come to it, we do want to slow down and just let the storyteller read the story. I think there's another liturgical option, which is that each week, or each day of Holy Week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then Friday, you would read one of the gospel passion accounts. So it goes like, I think it's Mark, Matthew, Luke, John, but I'm not sure for sure. But you get each one by themselves all through the week. And that's, to me, that's more the flavor I like, although it's a lot more work. Anyhow, any thoughts about that before we head into the text?
No, you're absolutely right on. We've got a lot of text to cover, so let's jump in.
Right on. So Luke chapter 22, verse 47. Remember, they're in the garden. He's been strengthened by an angel. Again, speaking of things that don't happen in every text, right? He's been strengthened by an angel. He comes back to his apostles. They're asleep. It's all of them, not just the three. And he says, you know, why are you sleeping? Get up. It's time, right? I pray that you may not enter temptation. While he was still speaking, there came a crowd, and the man called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. Now, last time we saw him was in this chapter a while back. We're never told by Luke that he left, which is really interesting to me. You just kind of got to assume that he left. But here he is now with the group. He drew near to Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, Judas, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? Oh, I love it. So, the tension is so high. And then those who were around him saw what would follow. Excuse me, when they saw what would follow, they said, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? Right? Remember, he's talked about if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. They're like, we got two swords. He's like, yeah, okay, here we go. Now is the time we're going to fight for you. And one of them struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. That is, he did this without even waiting for Jesus' word on the matter. We know from other gospels that this is Peter. But here again, notice Luke doesn't tell us that. So why? But Jesus said, no more of this. This is not the point. This is not what he's here for. And he touched his ear, the ear of the servant, and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple and elders who had come out against him, have you come out against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you day after day in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. But this is your hour, the power of darkness. Oh, that's great stuff right there, too. Pastor Beck, what do you think? Where do you want to go?
Okay, so a lot of kind of important details that you can kind of lose in the familiarity of this. I think that there's we would do well to pause just briefly and to comment on his self-identification as the Son of Man. This is by far Jesus' favorite self-identification, the Son of Man, right? And it's the idea there, the concept there, is that he's so much more than just a son of a man. He is the ultimate Son of Man. He is the representative of mankind before God, and then vice versa, back before God, from God, before mankind. And so he asks this question, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? He's really, bringing to our forefront just how crucial of a moment this is. And of course we know from the rest of Luke's gospel, that this is necessary, that this is going to happen. But here he asks that question. And then the disciples respond. They still don't get it. You know, that's a question that we've got a pastor's Bible study here that meets weekly, and we translate through the texts for the upcoming week. And that's a question that we find ourselves asking all the time is, at this point, do the disciples get it? Of course, the answer is usually no.
But yeah, right.
Do the disciples get it? And obviously they don't, right? Because they still think that Jesus is talking about back before when, he said, if you have a cloak, sell it by a sword. You know, and they say, look, we've got two swords. And he just says, it is enough. Right? So they draw their sword, right? We know from other Gospels, it's Peter. He draws his sword, strikes the high priest's servant, and Jesus won't have it, right? And then look at the players who are on the field here. The chief priests, the officers of the temple, and the elders. Now, what is their vocation? What are they called to do for the people of God?
Yeah, they're supposed to be like leading Passover service right now, right?
I think so. Yeah. Right now is about the time when it's their Easter, essentially. You know, right now is the time when it's time for them to be. I don't know about your ministry what Easter looks like for you, but that's the busiest time of year. My goodness, They should be concerning themselves with the things of God. And then, what are they doing instead? They came out against a robber with swords and clubs. You know, I don't carry any kind of a weapon when it comes to Easter. I don't even know where I could find a sword or a club. You know, and Jesus points this out. He says, when I was with you day after day in the temple, you didn't lay hands on me, but now it's your hour, now the power of darkness. He's talking specifically about the fact that he knows their hearts, the fact that these guys, from Jesus' own lips, they're in cahoots with the prince of darkness. Right? They're out there standing against what Jesus is doing and what God is doing. And, well, here they are, right? Here they are in their hour. You notice that when they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, that is, service in the temple, they didn't lay hands on Jesus. You know, there are times when they attempted to, but more or less, they've waited until now, until the moment when there won't be a large crowd witnessing, where there won't be a large crowd to see what they're about to do. You can just see the intent of their hearts here, right?
Isn't it something? The hour of darkness is also Jesus' hour, the hour when he comes to take the darkness into himself. Sharp Ryan with Pastor Dustin Beck, Luke 22. We'll be right back. Stick around.
Next time on Adventures in Odyssey, Olivia hears a story from her grandmother's past.
Who's this in the picture with you?
My dear friend, Esperanza.
It's a story of a hopeful girl.
You are my most precious friend.
A rude young boy.
The rock was here and you were there. Seemed like you should be together.
And a love that never dies.
Love is never for nothing.
Next time on Adventures in Odyssey.
Saturday mornings at 8:30 on KFUO.
Hi, this is Pastor Mark Azil, the LCMS Director of Campus Ministry and the Chancellor of LCMSU, inviting you to join us right here on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. in the Student Union. If you can't make it, Student Union is always available as a podcast at kfuo.org. Learn more about LCMSU at lcmsu.org. And remember, college is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help.
Wednesday afternoon at 2 on KFUO.
This week on Issues Etc., we'll get an introduction to the book of Esther from Pastor Brian Wolfmiller. We'll talk with Pastor Jonathan Fisk about the Lord's Prayer. We'll discuss the invocation of the saints with Pastor Paul McCain. And we'll study the hymn, God Loved the World So That He Gave, with Pastor Will Whedon.
Issues Etc., live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO.
The Son of Man is betrayed with a kiss. The one prophesied from of old to redeem the world, to defeat the ancient evil foe, does so by, well, having his own turn on him, pretending in a pretentious way unto peace, harmony, kindness, friendship, even while with swords and clubs they prepare to make good on him being the man of sorrows, giving him over to all the power of darkness. Yes, Luke chapter 22, an edge that maybe we don't look at as often as some of the other gospels when we're looking at the Passion of Jesus. We're talking with Pastor Dustin Beck. He's pastor at Trinity. Ooh, no, he's not. Yes, he is. Trinity, yep. Lutheran Church in Corpus Christi, Texas. This is Sharper Iron. We're picking up then at verse 54, unless Pastor Beck, anything else about that previous section before we move ahead? I know we got a lot of text, but I don't want to miss anything you want to say.
Well, we definitely have a lot of text, but in your lead-in there, you really hit on just the intimacy and the familiarity with which Judas betrays Jesus. You know, and I think that if we're to read this text devotionally, which I think that's part of what we're doing this morning, if we're to read this text devotionally, I think that looking at the type of betrayal that Jesus suffered, that this is something that ought to convict our own consciences, ought to remind each one of us of the times when we betray Jesus, the times when we, you know, everybody kind of thinks that, you know, Judas and Hitler and other folks like that, well, they're in their own special part of hell, and that's them, you know, I'm me. But when we're brutally honest with ourselves, we realize that, you know, our sin, you know, especially as Christians who should know better, is that exact thing. It's a willful disobedience, a willful lashing out against the grace of God in Jesus Christ. So I like to read these texts, you know, in scholarly pursuit, also in terms of devotion, because the text, you know, that's what it does to you. That's the way that the Spirit moves and works. So just wanted to point that out, that we're not just forensically looking at this, you know, as a couple of, you know, smart guys or anything like that. But we're actually Christians who are reading this text, as all of the hearers are as well.
Well, I think there's something to that, particularly the idea that the kiss is no accident. The way in which we betray God, the way in which we do sin, whatever our sin is, generally speaking, is with an attempt to hide it and make it seem like it's a good thing that we're doing, right? We're always wanting to justify our sin. That doesn't mean we're out trying to like sell drugs and, you know, you know, be pimps or anything. There are people who do that and we point our finger at them, but all the while we're sitting here with just as much evil in our hearts and we're like, oh, I'm all right. I'm good. Right. And that's the kiss, right? That's hiding it. That's the justifying of self behind a pretension to goodness. They seized Jesus, verse 54. They seized him and led him away, bringing him into the high priest's house. And Peter was following at a distance. And when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down among them. Again, this sounds so familiar, right? You know the story. Although, I tell you, and I haven't done a comparison beside the other Gospels, but this does feel different. My question with the flavor is always, why? What's he doing that's different and why? When they kindled the fire, Peter sat down among them. Verse 56, then a servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the light and looking closely at him, she's like got her breaking personal space. She's kind of like, hello, who are you? She said, this man was also with him. But he denied it, saying, woman, I do not know him. And a little later, someone else saw him and said, you also are not one of them. But Peter said, man, I am not. Interesting, the woman and man thing going on there, too. And after an interval of about an hour, still another insisted, saying, certainly, this man also was with him, for he too is a Galilean. I think there's actually some discrepancies there in who's doing all that talking, and I don't know if you're ready to deal with the liberal attacks of errancy on any of that. But Peter said, man, I do not know what you are talking about. And immediately, while he was still speaking, boom, the rooster crowed. That just had to break him, man. Had to break him. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter, which had to break him even more. Jeez. And Peter remembered the saying of the Lord, how he had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. And he went out and wept bitterly. And who can blame him? Who can blame him for that? Yeah. What are your thoughts?
Well, you mentioned, looking at the texts of the four Gospels side by side. And I would, encourage folks. I did this this morning because this was a thought that I had was, I really wish I would have sat down and printed out all the texts and highlighted and crossed back and forth and everything else. But I did just a quick search on a search engine and just said, Jesus's passion, fulfills comparison or something like that. And there's a really nice chart, on just some random website. And, I'm tracking along with it. And, the interesting thing here is that the other three Gospels, they give us a little bit more detail beforehand as far as the trial goes. I know we're going to get to that here a little bit later, but Luke tells us first and foremost what's going on with Peter, right? They seize Jesus and they lead him away, and then it's all about how the disciples are going to respond. You also notice that in Luke's Gospel, you don't have any account of the disciples fleeing. That's assumed, but that's in Matthew and in Mark that we get the disciples all fleeing, scattering like sheep. But here Jesus is indeed brought to the high priest's house, and before we go in the high priest's house with Jesus, we're going to stay outside with Peter for a little bit. And yeah, we have some slight variations between the Gospels in terms of who is seeing him and asking him first, and is it one person, is it a small group of people, etc. But the point remains the same, is that Peter constantly and continuously he denies Jesus. He says, no, you've got it wrong. And it begins to intensify, especially in Luke's Gospel, each time. You get this idea that by the end, he's almost kind of frustrated with it, right? I do not know what you are talking about. He completely disavows any knowledge even of who this Jesus is. And then while he's in the midst of this, the rooster crows, which is common to all of the Gospels, I believe so. And then you have that unique Lucan feature where in verse 61, the Lord turns and looks at Peter Yeah, that's always stuck out to me. You know, that's one of those most powerful moments, I think, in our mind's eye, is that, you know, Peter, not only does he know it and remember it, but Jesus knows it. You know, and that's something that, you know, if we're just kind of smushing together Matthew and Mark, or if we're just looking at, you know, John, we miss out on that detail. And that reminds you just a little bit more of the fact that, you know, Luke has done his homework. Luke is not making this stuff up. He's gone. He's talked to Peter. He's talked to, you know, to Mary. He's, like you said, he's talked to Paul. But then we had Peter, Paul, and Mary. That's a whole other thing, you know. Yeah, he's done his homework, and he's asked them about these accounts, and he wants to be a faithful witness to these. So, yeah, you have Jesus' own words that recount just exactly what's going to happen. And in Luke's gospel, when Jesus says something, it's going to happen. That's just you can take it to the bank. You know for sure, right?
Yeah, that's definitely been something we've seen, that Jesus speaks and it comes to pass. A couple things. I'm going to say about three things here, and feel free to respond to all of them or none of them, as you will. But, you know, not going past that look at Peter too fast, and the theology that's in that, right? I mean, we just see it happen. We're like, oh, Jesus knows. But no, this is just it. Jesus is like getting shouted at, and they're pulling his beard out and accusing him of stuff, and he's God. So he's like, oh, yeah, right now, Peter, over there. Yep, I see you, Peter. Back to getting my face punched, right? Like, he knows the divinity of Jesus in this moment. And we assume that as we get the feel out of it, right? And yet to stop and say, why do we assume that? What do we know about Jesus that there is being expressed so fully? What a thought also then. I don't know, maybe someone's already done this, but I can just see in like a classic Renaissance-style art a portrait of the trial from Peter's perspective. So like, you, the looker in the portrait, are Peter. You never see Peter, but instead you see like a fire and these people kind of looking at you a little askance, and like in the background there's Jesus and all this stuff's going on, but then you, the only one that's like really piercing you with eyes is Jesus way over there, and he's looking right at you and you're looking right at him. That would be awesome. And there's gotta be like a rooster somewhere in the picture.
You could throw in a rooster somewhere too.
Oh yeah, man, that'd be great. Third thing was, again, when you mentioned that the disciples didn't flee, or we weren't told that they flee, this is so hard. We know these texts so well to not just congeal and combine them. But if you can just stop enough to think of Luke as a movie for a moment, and the way things have happened and how different it is. I'm going to go back a little further. So you're at the Lord's Supper. Everybody's there, including Judas. And again, you're watching this on a screen, right? You're watching the movie, and Jesus is giving the Lord's Supper out, and then he's talking and stuff, and you're going to the garden, and then suddenly Judas is there with clubs. You never saw him leave, right? Wait a minute. What happened here, right? It's almost like an action moment, right? It just totally throws you off. And then, you know, they grab Jesus and hard cut. We're in a courtyard. Like, there's just nothing else happens. You're in a courtyard, and Peter's like getting talked to, right? Fireplace, and, you know, it just, it's moving fast in a lot of ways, right? But we're so busy. I'm not accusing anybody individually. Me too, right? We just have all these images that we already know that we are just putting into the text. And it's not that that's wrong. It's true historically. But in terms of the storytelling, it kind of gets in the way of the storytelling a little bit. So, like I said, three things.
You mentioned, you know, like a movie. And, I mean, my mind goes to the Passion of the Christ movie that came out, 15, 20 years ago. My mind always goes to that, and that's kind of, you know, I read the Gospels, and, you know, they did such a beautiful job with that film of depicting, you know, just everything in such detail, that's kind of where my mind's eye goes and what I kind of see in my head. But you're right. I mean, this is... There are things that are left out. There are things that are assumed. There are things, you know, I remember one of the things that kind of surprised me about that movie is the amount that they expanded upon them leading him from the Garden of Gethsemane to the high priest's house. You know, I mean, they showed the journey and the beating along the way and everything else. And that's just never something that I had, like, because the scriptures just kind of say, and they led him to the place. You know, but there's this more drawn out kind of, you know, for the sake of what that movie was trying to communicate, Anyways, we could talk about film for a good long time, I'm sure. Now, here's a question that I want to throw back at you, because you're absolutely right. Verse 61, the Lord turned and looked at Peter. That is Jesus and his divinity knowing, right? But, you know, how do we interpret that look? That's a huge question, isn't it? Right?
Is that
Jesus looking in judgment? Is that Jesus looking in, I told you so? Is that Jesus looking with compassion to say, hey, Peter, you know, this is all going to work out?
Yeah, man. All of the above. you know, in Eastern Christian iconography, right? We don't have a lot of this in our Missouri Synod churches, although we could, we're free to do so. These icon drawings of saints and Jesus particularly. There is the most common one, I think, is Christ Pontocrator, the Almighty Christ. This is Jesus. This is a guy with a beard, right? And he's holding his fingers up, you know, with the two natures in one person and the three persons in the Trinity kind of shape. But in that picture, next time you see it, if you ever see it, look, and you'll notice that one eye is looking at you and one eye is looking just past you. And the eye that's looking at you is the eye of judgment. And the eye that's looking past you is the eye of mercy. He's overlooking you. Yeah. And so I think there's something of that in this moment. It's like, Peter, see, I told you, I got you, you're a sinner, but I'm doing this for you. And like, it's all there, right? It's got to all be there, because that's the theology. Yeah.
Right. No, I agree. That's something that, you know, that's an important thing to ponder is, you know, what exactly does that look mean? And what does that look mean, you know, in terms of our lives as well?
Well, I think it's important in that, particularly in that, to not miss that it is ultimately a merciful look. It is not ultimately judgment, right? He is looking at him because, Peter, I have prayed for you that when you have fallen, you will come back and you will restore your brothers, right?
Right.
Satan wanted to have you. It's not going to happen.
And everything that Jesus is enduring, even as he's taking this momentary break from being beaten to a pulp, you know, he's looking at Peter and saying, I'm enduring this for you. For that denial that you just left your lips, right? No, that's beautiful.
Yeah. And then getting back to the devotion, how Peter is emblematic of us as Christians here, more than Judas, right? I mean, we want to be wary lest we be Judas, but we are Peter, every one of us. We think too highly of ourselves. We talk too fast. We assume that we're standing for Jesus no matter what. When push comes to shove, we are who we are. And Jesus is doing what he's doing because he is who he is and he loves us anyway. And to see ourselves in that, both the bitterness and the judgment we deserve and then the mercy we receive is pretty key, I think, to reading this as a Christian.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is, if the text of Judas and his betrayal was to be read devotionally, and like you very well, you know, very astutely pointed out, you know, we ought not identify too perfectly with Judas, because you know, Judas is a man who does not know repentance. Judas is a man who does not experience and receive that mercy and that grace on the other side. But if that's the case, if we can even in small way relate to that, then much more can we relate to Peter, you know, who falls and who is ultimately raised up again.
Yeah. At the risk of going too allegory, you know, Judas in many ways is every man right? Is our human nature. And Peter is every man who is a Christian. And as we know, the Christian doesn't stop being every man. Right? We still have Judas in my heart, but it's not Judas alone. And that's the glorious gospel that comes to us. Let's look at about the three more verses here with this next little segment before we take another pause. So, getting into what's going on with Jesus, we focused on Peter, back to Jesus. Now, the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him as they beat him. Like, that's just awesome. So it's not bad enough that he's been captured. Now we're going to get ours out of him at this point, you know, get our pound of flesh. They also blindfolded him and kept asking him, prophesy who it is that struck you. And other gospel writers talk about this too. It's, oh, what a clever little game. You know, ha ha, prophet can't see me, you know, that kind of thing. And they said many other things against him, blaspheming him. And that's an interesting turn of phrase there. If the Bible does not teach that Jesus is God, then how do you blaspheme him? You know, it's really kind of an impossible thing to do. What are your thoughts? Pretty short, pretty succinct.
Yeah, we don't get nearly as much detail here, although I think that that it's kind of understood that this is a snippet of what's going on both before and after, you know, that Jesus is being mocked and beaten kind of ever since he's arrested. In terms of the kind of finer points here, you know, this blindfolding, you know, this is, I guess you would say, kind of the ultimate insult to somebody who is purported to be a prophet, which Jesus is throughout the book of Luke, you know, is, you know, prophesy who is it that struck you. You know, a prophet is all about seeing things and proclaiming things. And so, you know, you, the one that calls yourself, you know, that has been called a prophet, and that everything else that has kind of, Jesus carries himself as a prophet, you know, in the Gospels. And so now this kind of turning on the tables, and this is the way that they're blaspheming him, is that they're basically ridiculing God, right? They're saying, you know, essentially, like, you know, if you really are a prophet of God, you know, then tell us who hit you. You know, prove it to us that you're a prophet, you know, and I imagine saying all kinds of other terrible things, but they're bringing God into the conversation. You know, I mean, this is not kind of a, they're not angry with Jesus, just Jesus. They're angry that Jesus speaks for God, right? That he is purported to be a prophet, one who speaks the word of God. And so they're bringing God into this argument, you know, into this conflict. And I think that's, you know, for the reader, in Luke's day or today, I think for the reader who sits here and hears that this is how they're blaspheming God. You know, we just stand here with our mouths kind of slack-jawed saying, oh my goodness, like, that's the way that they treated this guy. You know, look at the disdain that they have for him. That's, you know, that's one of the things that has always struck me about the Passion accounts, is that, you know, it's not just that these people, that these people didn't like Jesus, or that these people were fiercely jealous of him. I mean, they had a real vitriol towards him. You know, he was enemy number one in their books. And, you know, a guy who comes and who, you know, raises the dead and heals the sick and preaches the good news of the kingdom, you know, man, it's not, you don't find yourself in a good place when you're opposed to that guy.
Well, we talked about this with Mark's gospel a little bit more, that to best construction the powers of darkness for a moment, if I might, these Pharisees, it's not like they don't have a way to have theology on their side, or the priests as well here. If the guy is actually a false prophet, and he's doing this by the finger of Satan, if this guy's a witch doctor par excellence, right, like, they do need to deal with him. By the law, he must die, technically, right? They have to do something. So there's something there to that, not to then say that they actually have an excuse. They don't, but you can kind of get inside their head a little bit here. And then on top of that, okay, so just because the prophet's supposed to die according to the law doesn't mean you're supposed to beat him before you kill him and make fun of him and do all these other things, right? It is, the law doesn't say to do that. And so the aggression really betrays their using of the law for their own enmity, as opposed to faithfully attempting to preserve Israel from false prophecy. So I think you can kind of have both edges there a little bit, and it amplifies what's going on. They do think they're doing the right thing, even as they betray, how do I say it, as they make void the word of God for the sake of their tradition. Any other thoughts on that text before we move to the next part?
Well, I mean, just, you know, to echo what you just said, I mean, in the gospel lesson, the section in between that they chopped out in the gospel lesson this past Sunday, you know, in John 16, I mean, that's, there will come a time when people think that, you know, killing you, they're offering a service to God. right? Mm. And that's exactly, you know, it's, I know that's a different gospel, and I know that we said we wouldn't do that. But, you know, that's exactly what's going on here in Good Friday, is we're right here, and these people, you know, deep down, they think that they're doing this, you know, out of service to God. But, yeah, they have exceeded their mandate, because cruel and unusual didn't really enter into it.
Yeah. If I can say to you, you Christian out there who's listening to this, you know, sometimes these days we're a little afraid to talk. We're a little afraid to talk about what we believe and why we believe it, particularly to those who are close to us. I mean, it's one thing if it's passing on the streets. Another thing if it's my daughter who doesn't go to church anymore. Yeah. It's one thing if it's my neighbor or my mom or my friend. And so we hold our mouths because we're afraid that they will be angry with us, that they will not like us. And what we tend to forget at this moment is it's not us they got a problem with at all. It's God they have a problem with. And if they hated him, well, then they're going to hate you. They hated him first. So open your mouth. Fear not. Stand up, Christian. Believe what you believe. Sharper iron. We'll be right back. Stick around.
Thy strong word bespeaks us righteous, bright with thine own holiness. What an unspeakable blessing to be able to open the scriptures together every single day and spend time listening, pondering, and proclaiming what they unfailingly reveal, God's great love for you and me in Jesus.
Thy Strong Word, weekday mornings at 11 on Worldwide KFUO. Underwritten by Lutheran Heritage Foundation, lhfmissions.org.
The story of Worldwide KFUO is a tale of technology. Radio was new in 1924 when KFUO was born to serve Christ the Savior. Now, KFUO is still finding new broadcast technologies so we can spread the gospel to the world via the web, smartphones, tablets, and new intelligent speaker devices. And when the next big thing is unveiled, we'll be there too. Broadcasting the good news at the forefront of technology, we are Worldwide KFUO.
Hi, I'm Pastor Mark Hawkinson, host of Moments of Assurance here on Worldwide KFUO. On the next Moments of Assurance weekend, I'll share thoughts with you about the last days and people who have a form of godliness but deny its power. What does it mean to have only a form of godliness? I'll share thoughts about that on the next MOA weekend, heard Saturday and Sunday mornings at 7:45 a.m. Central here on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Again, here's the thing. They're going to hate you. The world is going to despise you when they learn what you believe and why you believe it about Jesus. He is particular. He is scandalously particular in his accusations against our lack of righteousness and in the gift of righteousness he comes to give. And we're seeing him do that in Luke chapter 22, and we're having to confront in ourselves a little bit here today. Our terror at joining him on this path. I think it's pretty unlikely, Pastor Beck, that we're going to get killed next week here in the United States. But again, I think it's pretty important that we recognize just how much we've been silenced in the present culture by our fear of not even being killed, just our fear of not being liked. Talking with Pastor Dustin Beck, he's pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Corpus Christi, Texas, about Luke chapter 22, verses 47 to 71 here on Sharper Iron. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, senior pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Rockford, Illinois. Moving into the text, verse 66, but do you want a chance to respond to any of what I just said?
No, I think you're right on.
All right. Verse 66 then, continuing, the council trial, really, we're just kind of like getting to the trial here. I think this is really, I'm not sure what to make of this turn of phrase, and I haven't studied it enough to know. When day came, verse 66, I mean, we know from other gospels, other writers, that they don't really get to Pilate until around dawn. So what's going on here? How is Luke defining day at this point? And I think that's a fair question. When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council and said, "If you are the Christ, tell us." Which, okay, fair question, right? That's a good question to ask Jesus in faith, which they're not. But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask you, you will not answer." Which, that's interesting too. But key though, you know, people say, I just need to see a miracle. I just need proof of God, and then I'll believe. No, you won't. No, you won't. You will doubt that, too. If you won't believe what's obvious, then you're not going to believe what's obvious. But from now on, he says, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God, right? Boom. And what is that power of God? It's the cross, which then is the power of the ascension as well. So they all said, are you the Son of God then? And he said to them, you say that I am. Again, this really interesting turn of phrase. It's an ancient world way of talking, which is, I think it's a play on the fact that the words are all built on inflection. So there is no question mark in Greek, you know. So the word could be a sentence. You are the Son of God then, right? It's just how you would spin it. He's like, look, your words are in fact telling me that I am. Then they said, what further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips. And then they're going to go to Pilate in the next verse. We'll get to that tomorrow. But, well, what are your thoughts? Again, familiar, that day came parts to my biggest confusion. Yeah. Where do you want to go?
Well, if it's okay, I'd like to start at the end there, because I think the most profound thing is tying those last two verses. Then we'll go back to 66, if that's
sure thing.
Okay. So their final words, what further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips. But, you know, the thing is his lips just said, you say that I am. Huh. So they've heard it from their own lips. You are the Son of God. You know, that's the question that's leveled. And like you pointed out, you know, in Greek, this looks exactly like you are the Son of God.
Yeah,
and it's
right.
Understood to be a question. And he says, you said so, you know, and so this is Jesus essentially. He's not willing to get into a wrestling match or an argument with them. He's not willing. He gives up his right to defend himself. He gives up, you know, his right to counsel, I guess we would say. He's not going to lodge a defense, you know, to save his life, right? But he would rather lose it. Instead, he just allows their words to be the final word, the final verdict. You are the Son of God. You say so. What further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips. Well, they actually heard it from their own lips when they said, you are the Son of God. I think that's just an interesting turn of phrase, like you said, just a really really kind of poetic way that one of the features that I love in all four of the Gospels is when Jesus' detractors wind up being the ones that actually proclaim him to be who he is. You know, I mean, Caiaphas in John's mm-hmm. Gospel is famous for this. Don't you see? The whole world has gone out after him. In the very next verse, some Greeks come running up and saying, you know, we want to see Jesus, you know, and don't you see? It's better that one man should die for the sins of the world than a whole people, you know, for the people, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's a very powerful point here at the end of this chapter. Backing up just a bit when day came, I looked into this a bit, and I didn't really find a lot that was helpful. The footnote in the Lutheran Study Bible from Concordia Publishing House, which I would recommend for all of the listeners, it offers a little bit of insight, but it just doesn't offer a lot of clarification. It says, when day came, a night trial of Jesus was held at the high priest's house. We've heard about that, and it's in Matthew, Mark, and John as well. However, a night trial's verdict was invalid. I don't really know where they get that, but they don't provide all of their sources. And then the assembly of the rulers is the Sanhedrin coming together to discuss internal Jewish matters. So essentially, my answer to that when day came, you know, you've got to remember that we're dealing with two separate timelines here, because for the Jews, a day began the way that I would love to start my days, which is the day began as soon as it's evening time, right? And so the first thing that you do, and this comes all the way back from Genesis 1, there was evening and there was morning the first day, right? And I think that we've probably talked about this on the show many times. But so for a Jew, the first thing they get to do every day is eat dinner and go to bed, which I just... That sounds like the perfect start to a day for me, you know, because it's in the evening. That's when the day begins, right? And so you've got that one timeline, and then at the same time, you know, so that's why we can say that on Thursday afternoon, before it had become Friday that evening, that was when Jesus celebrated the Passover with the disciples. And then Maundy Thursday, he goes to the Mount of Olives. While he's there, it becomes, Good Friday, and then so he is betrayed on Good Friday. His trial takes place on Good Friday, and by 12 o'clock noon, he's nailed to the cross. So we've got a lot of events that we've got to squeeze in there. But I think this, at least my understanding of this when day came, is just as soon as they could get the Sanhedrin together, as soon as they could consider it to be daytime, so that's probably, I guess we would call that, just as dawn is beginning to approach. That's when they get this together, and they might have even got together a couple of minutes early. But so just as soon as they could get the assembly together, they got them together for this this kind of verification of the trial.
Yeah, I can see that. You got the bit with Herod as well. It's tough. One of the thoughts though that I came to, and I'd need to go and look more at Luke's use of the word day, but certainly Jesus talks about his hour has not yet come at various times. Maybe this is like, and I'm looking at the Greek, which is like literally, and as it was the day, right? Like it's which day, right? The day of days, the fullness of time, as it was at last. Now, the time for the journey to be complete. Here we go. Like almost like it's a chapter break, right? We will miss that because we're just kind of reading with our own chapter breaks and numbers and all that kind of thing. So that'd be one of my thoughts on that. About 2 minutes left. Closing thoughts on the morning.
Well, closing thoughts on the morning are that a text like this is not something that we should skim or gloss over. When things like this come up in our devotional readings, the Treasury of Daily Prayer or Portals of Prayer or things like that, when a text comes up, we ought to slow down, to tap the brakes a little bit. And we ought to invest a little bit of time in some of these passages that, we know them. This upcoming Sunday, we're going to hear John 3:16. And, we've heard that. We've been there. We've done that. But it helps. It's infinitely helpful for us to slow down and to hear these texts, to look through them and to see what the Spirit does with them, because God is faithful, and that's the way that He has chosen to work, is not through, an advanced level of study, but instead the simple, plain words of Scripture. Right, so we get to slow down. We get to look at things like Luke 22, this text that most of us could probably recite more or less in large sweeping strokes from memory. This is the good stuff. This is the gospel for us. This is Jesus bleeding and dying. This is Jesus being denied and being betrayed. This is Jesus who loves us.
Pastor Dustin Beck, he's pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Corpus Christi, Texas. Still got about a minute here, just a little bit less than that, actually. How are things going in the rebuild down there? 30 seconds.
Things are continuing on. We've got a crew from Kansas City right now. It's going to be a busy summer here, and there's plenty of work to be done. We are staying busy. Tons of rebuilding in Port Aransas, Texas, and Rockport. If people are interested, they should check out the Texas District website, txlcms.org.
As a California native, Oregon native too, living in Illinois, I got to say, God bless Texas. Yeah.
Yes,
Pastor
sir.
Dustin Beck, Trinity Lutheran Church, Corpus Christi, Texas. Talk about Luke chapter 22 here on Sharper Iron. My friends, what Jesus did on the cross, He did for you. He looked to you across time and space the way He looked to Peter that evening. And he sees everything that you are. He knows everything that you are. Weakness, failure, brokenness, sin. And He says, I do this for you anyway. You're my child now. I love you. I've bought you with a price. You are mine. And the resurrection I'm about to achieve, the ascension I'm going to do for you, the return at the end of days, is all to make good on the fact that I'm not going to leave you where you are. I'm going to make you just like me for all eternity. My friends, I'm Pastor Jonathan Fisk. I look forward to waking up with you at that dawn.